There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
As an artist of faith, my creativity and spirituality are integral to my identity.
But I'm caught between two worlds.
Luckily, I found Be Make Do, and I'm ready to be who I was created to be.
Be Make Do, the podcast. Listen at soulmakers.org/bemakedo.
Looking for a fun way to win up to 25 times your money this basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. You could turn $10 into $250. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/fan and use code FAN. That's code FAN at prizepicks.com/fan.
Must be present in certain states. Visit prizepicks.com for restrictions and details.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Well, listen, Ma'am Parrish, this is really an honour. And I have to say, first of all, have you got clean underwear on, as you promised?
Oops, I forgot. I may have a few skid marks, but that's okay. No sharts, let's put it that way.
Oh, well, I got none on, because I promised as well. But there you go. This is going to go all the wrong direction, I know.
Oh, let me tell you something. It's only down from here, folks. So get ready for a bumpy ride.
Exactly. So listen, I want to take you back really, really early when you were very young and living with your parents in...
When I was in the womb. Yes, I remember.
When you were in the womb. Well. When you were with your parents in Brooklyn. And just wondered what sort of music or cultural influences there were in the family that you were surrounded by.
We didn't listen to radio. There was those days for transistor radio, because I'm old as fuck. So those were the old transistor radios. It was never music. If it was ever on, it was like talk or news radio. And I had a paper route. So I bought a record player. And the first record I bought was Grand Funk Railroad Live Double Album. Not because I knew who the group was, but because you bought two records for the price of one. You know, I just grabbed the first thing that was like on sale and listened to that, God knows. But there was no music in the house. Even in the car, I think they listened to talk radio. My father played piano really badly. That oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, left hand going da-da, and it drove me crazy. I had two or three piano lessons, and the teacher hit me across the knuckles for hitting a wrong note, and I called her a fucking dirty cunt at 8 years old, and I never took piano lessons after that because she didn't want to deal with me. So gives you an idea of where I was coming from. So there was very little music in the house, and to this day, I can't read or write music. So, but I do everything by ear, including orchestrations and choirs and all that kind of stuff. So,
did they put any value on culture or creativity?
Did I put value on cultural creativity?
No, your parents. Then? Your parents. Did they put any value on that?
No, because, you know, there wasn't opera. You know, there wasn't church singing on Sunday. There wasn't visits to anything. I think at one point, my mother probably realized I was a big puff and took me to a Broadway show. But for the most part, no. I mean, it was just a very middle class working household. My father got up at 8 in the morning and didn't come back to 6 at night. And my mother kept house, and there wasn't much music, you know. Went to school, came home. The television was on all the time. That was the source of entertainment or noise in the house. But I mean, culturally, there wasn't any mind expanding things. That happened later when I left home. I discovered libraries and museums and stuff like that. Very, very early on, no.
going back, because your mother was a schizophrenic, I understand.
Yeah. So back in those days, it's different than it was today. Like, now we're very aware of mental illness and forgiving or whatever it is. But back then, we were just a crazy family. My mother was weird. And I suffered a lot from it. So we could go on forward. I was actually sexually abused, but not by my parents, but by a doctor and then by a pedophile that I lived with when I ran away from home. But as a result of all that, I've had to have therapy, which is great. So I figured out my mother's situation. She was schizophrenic, bipolar manic, which turns into schizophrenia. You know, it's all in the same extremes. And I think she wanted me to be so perfect that her schizophrenia, she was absolutely extreme. You know, you have to be perfect. You have to, you know, say please. And if you don't, you know, we tie you to a radiator and turn up the steam, which she tried. I escaped, or knock you unconscious. Or I remember one day I was lying in my bedroom and she came in at midnight and I was asleep. Are you awake? And I'm like, what? What happened? Oh, you're not awake. Get out of my house. And threw me out in the snow in my underwear with nothing else. And the neighbors came and put a blanket around me. But in those days, you didn't call the police. There wasn't the child services and all that kind of stuff. You were just the crazy family.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, it was terrible because in addition to that dysfunction, my mother couldn't keep a tidy house. So it wasn't like hoarders where there was dirt everywhere, but there was neat, what would you call it? She was compulsive in the way the house was very disorganized, like a hoarder, but nothing dirty. Neat piles of newspapers, neat piles, stuff would come out of the washing machine, the dryer, and she'd put them on the couch in neat piles, but everything was piled up. We'd come home and put bags of groceries on the table, and there'd be like piles of boxes lined up in a row and canned goods and stuff lined up in a row. So I couldn't have friends come home and visit. I always visited other friends' homes, and I was always in fear that people are going to find out that, oh, you're that crazy family, or how come we always go to my house, not yours? Or if they came in the house, at one time, my closest friend, I said, look, you can come by, but just understand my mom's not feeling well. And he came by and was like, oh my God, like this place is like, not dirty, but like crazy. You know what I mean? But you see little old ladies and they have plastic bags and paper bags, you know, neatly packed up. So it wasn't like Grey Gardens where they were living on a bed, you know, and having food everywhere. It wasn't like that, but it was very stressful for a child. I was 8 years old, you know, I was discovering the world, you know, and it was incredibly dysfunctional. And my father couldn't deal with the fact that my mother had mental illness. So he had horse blinders on. He came home and just stared at the TV while everything blew up around him. And ironically, my sister didn't get any of the abuse because my family was an old school family. So the firstborn had to be perfect kind of routine. So it was very, 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 very rough, very rough.
So how come you went to the performing arts school in New York, the Fame School, as it's sort of known? How come you went there when you come from a family that really wasn't sort of culturally interested in any way?
I think my mother knew I was different, fabulously different. And she enrolled me in like an acting school when I was like 10 years old. So I think that went off well. I got a little independent movie for the Board of Education on deaf kids. And so I wasn't, that performing arts school was dancers, musicians, and actors. In fact, it was, all the guys were gay. They called it an all-girls school, even though it wasn't. My mother, there was something like 2,000 kids, and they only took several hundred for that first year of class. And my mother, being a nut, worked in my favor because she marched up there and banged on the door and demanded that her son get an audition, or, you know, she's going to blow the place up. And I got an audition a week before school started, and that's how I got into it. I went in an audition and got it. And 4 months later, I was thrown out with Freddie Prinze. I don't know if you guys had in Europe, but there was Chico and the Man. And he was quite the class clown. He would run down the hallway, open the door, and you know, your mother sucks cock, and shut the door, and the whole class would crack up. And I was really bad in school, you know, whoopee cushions, fart jokes, you know, spitballs, you know, because I came from a dysfunctional home. So there, I had a lot of anxiety, a lot of panic, a lot of stress, and I vented it the only other place away from home, which was school. So I was never arrested. I was never a bad kid. I never hurt anybody. I never get into fights, but I couldn't sit still because bubbling under this beautiful little cherub face was, you know, fucking hell. So.
And this school was in the middle of the sort of 42nd Street pool area, wasn't it?
Now that I look at it, it was fucking great. It was in the middle of Times Square in the 70s. When you see those black exploitation movies, guys with fur pimp hats and, you know, hookers with just little things covering their nipples. I mean, it was 42nd Street at its dirty. I remember seeing Deep Throat up on the, you know, Linda Lovelace, Deep Throat up on the things and going, oh my God, I love this, you know. But they wouldn't let you out of class because you were ninth graders, you were children to go to lunch. So they locked, literally, I mean, it was a fire trap, if God forbid if anything happened, but they chain locked the doors. And kids, the lunchroom was the gym, and they put out tables. And I think the school bought a record player, and they had a very early DJ, or just somebody playing records. And just like the movie Fame, we didn't spill out onto the streets on top of the taxi cabs. People would dance on the tables because there were dancers, and it was a wonderful, you know, lunchtime. And then we'd have to go back to voice and diction class, where you tap your T's on the top with your tongue, you know, and all that. And I was like talking like this. I was from Brooklyn, you know, the rain in Spain. It was like that My Fair Lady thing, you know. Roll your R's, you know, you're in the theater.
So did this Eliza Doolittle person go to 42nd Street in the evening?
Manny Eliza Doolittle did, because you had to I had to walk past it to get to the subway. And then one day I noticed the men's room and all these guys going in there, and I walked in and they're all sticking their schlongs out, and I thought, they're not peeing. I wonder what's going on in here. So I've discovered my first, as you call it over there, cottage. We call it a tea room, and my first cruising situation. So on the way home, I'd make a pit stop. You know, nothing happened. I was too young, not too young, but I didn't do anything. But I was like, I got to stop in the bathroom on the way home and look at all these guys with their schlongs hanging out. Free peaks for, you know, a ninth-year-old kid, ninth grade kid, you know what I mean? So, you know, hormones are kicking in. So, but you did get to experience it. I remember hookers coming up to me, hey, baby, you want to go out? And I'm like, I want to go home. She goes, I want to go home too. But I got to make money or I'm going to get beat up. I said, well, all right, honey, you know. Sorry, you're barking up the wrong tree.
At the same time, you were also at the Metropolitan Opera, weren't you? Like,
yes, yeah, so
you had some sort of job
that
there.
Was in the music department, was in the choir. And we became friends. And he said, you know, in the evening, see, I didn't have a curfew. And my mother maybe didn't have a sense of time, but I can come in at 11 o'clock at night. Nobody, like, where were you? And if they did, I didn't give a fuck. You know, at that point, life was so bad. He said, I work at the opera, and you become something called an extra or a supernumerary, I think is the term. You're the person on stage that holds a spear, or you're the army, or the crowd of villagers. And I lied. I told everybody I was 19 when I was 13, because I was very tall. You know, 6 foot something. I was quite tall, 6'3" or something like that, which led to the doctor, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I worked at the opera, and my mother found, I would come home with like grease paint in my head. Where were you? Well, I'm working at the opera house. Well, she, I don't know, found out that there were notorious homosexuals working at the opera. They were fucking opera queens, right? And nobody bothered me or touched me, you know, but she wrote a letter that my son can't be around notorious homosexuals. He's only 13. And they went, you told us you were 19, get out, you know, rightly so. I remember one day, one of the guys came in and said, I just got organic mescaline. Wouldn't it be funny if we all drop acid and go on stage? And of course, at 13, I was like, sure. So we all did a hit of acid. And we're standing, we're in loincloths with orange paint and spears and sandals. We're standing on the edge of the stage and the acid kicks in for everybody. And we're marching through like the desert or something like that. It was like Aida or something. And there were horses and a chariot in front of us. And we get on stage and those were the old incandescent lights at 1,000 watts. So it was really warm. I'm tripping, oh, it's orange and yellow and the sun. And in between my toes, I could feel that really warm sand as we're washed across the stage. And when you got the other side, we had all stepped in horse shit with our sandals and our feet were full of horse shit. So they had to pull us off to the side and spray our feet. That you're not going in the hallway. Come here, quiet, quiet, quiet. But I spent a lot of that time. The Met had elevator stages that went down 3 or 4 stories. They would put the scenery on there, raise it up so they didn't have to physically move scenery. And you weren't allowed to be on stage because you could fall down 2 or 3 flights, while that stage pit was open. And I used to hide between the curtain and the proscenium arch and watch how the theater operated. And my love for drama and theater, which went into my shows, came from that.
That's amazing.
Even though I was doing an actor at high school performing arts, we were just learning voice and diction and improv. But here I was on the great stage of the Metropolitan Opera House and an education you couldn't get anywhere, watching them rig something, watch the lights, watch the scrims come down. And it's quite, I thought, wow, I could do this. I could do this.
What triggered the decision to leave home so young?
Well, my mother was very abusive and about a year. I left home at 14. I was growing so tall and so fast at 10 years old, my mother took me to a doctor. She found out through the New York City school system that there was a study going on for exceptionally tall children. And I can't say the name of the place because part of my deal and settlement is a non-disclosure agreement, but the doctor turned out he was a pedophile. And I'd go into the office and get naked, and it was a growth doctor, and he'd start taking Polaroids and sit on my lap, and he would have an erection and putting his fingers in my rectum and telling me I have to masturbate and let me show you how to do it. And he'd drop his pants and do it. This went on for 3 years. And I mean, I remember going home and my rear end was bloody. My underwear was bloody and I threw it in a neighbor's bin because I thought my mother would find it and blame me for what he did to me. So by the time I was 13 and going to high school performing arts, I was getting away from home more often and my mother was getting sicker and sicker. And I decided, that's it. I'm out of here. And that same kid worked at took magic classes at the YMCA. This is a funny story. And I went with him to magic classes rather than being home. And it was in the basement of the YMCA on 63rd Street. And I had to run to the bathroom and I probably was squatting to pee. Yeah. And there's a little hole in the wall and a penis comes through, a dick comes through. My first glory hole. So I got scared at 14 and I ran out into Central Park, right into what was the gay cruising area of Central Park at that time. And the guy follows me, gives me his key and says, I live upstairs at the Y, why don't you come up? So we go up, we fool around, and afterwards I start crying, my mother, my this, my that. I didn't even know if I was gay or straight or what. He goes, don't worry, honey. If you can always come here and I'll, you have refuge here. Well, I went straight home, packed my bags, came back and knocked on his door. And he's like, what are you doing? And I said, you said I could come here if there was a problem. So I wound up moving in for a couple of weeks. And then we got an apartment and he worked at the famed Continental Bathhouse in New York. And I used to ask him where he works and he wouldn't tell me. And I followed him one day and he went in and you had to pay to get in. You didn't show ID in those days, but if you had the money, they'd probably let you in. And the security guard said, all right, get out of here. And I, batted my eyelash and I went, hey, mister, see you later, honey, let me in. And he let me in. And I remember Steve, who I was with, the guy, he worked as a short order cook at that place because there were no clocks. You could stay for 24 hours. And if you wanted to order a hamburger or breakfast, there was like a little diner counter. And I remember sliding along the walls and it was a Saturday night and the show was starting. And I sat down. And I saw Bette Midler perform when she was a nobody. And she said, I'd like to introduce my band. And this is George, the drummer, and blah, blah, blah. And this is Barry Manilow, our piano player. So that's up on YouTube. You can actually see the night that I was there. You don't see me, but you can see the night that I was there. So here I was, 14 years old, around hundreds of notorious homosexuals. And I used to sneak in all the time, follow him to work and sneak in. I remember Rudolf Nureyev, the dancer, laying on his belly with a guy pounding him, and the door was open, and three or four guys were jerking off, looking in the door, because he was an exhibitionist. He was a ballerina, I call him, but a ballet dancer. So he liked putting on a show on and off stage. But that kind of behavior and the sexual freedom in New York of the 80s late 70s, 80s, was not strange. It sounds very strange and shocking now, but that was culture, gay culture, you know what I mean? And yeah, you know, listen, I say it this way. If you have a bunch of men in a room with nobody to say no, and they're all gay, or, you know, and they're all horny, who's going to stop it? You know, there's nobody to police it. So things get crazy pretty quickly.
I mean, okay, that side is, you know, very liberal, very open. And then New York was also like the Wild West in a lot of ways during that era.
It was like the Wild West. Most of the, I grew up in Brooklyn. It was an Italian and Jewish neighborhood, and the mafia was in my neighborhood. And the biggest mafia kingpin, his son at 12 years old, babysat me. So I grew up, you needed something. Hey, what do you need? I'll get it for you. You know what I mean? I need a TV. Don't worry, it fell off the truck. You know, here, give me $10. So all the clubs and everything was mafia run. You walked in Central Park at night, you got killed. You know what I mean? It's, if you were gay, another fag, drag queen got beat up. You know, so it was the Wild West, and it was much different. I remember coming out of gay bars and cops would follow you and beat you with a nightstick or hit you in the crotch really hard. You know, what are you doing there? Looking for dicks? You know what I mean? So it was totally with people like, now, oh my God. But that was, hey, you're toughen up, buttercup. You know, you had to survive, you know? And when I left home, after living with that guy, it didn't work out. I wound up going, now I knew where the gay area of Central Park was. And I remember sitting there, and I was 14 years old. And this guy comes up to me and says, hey, you know, you want to come back to my place for, you know, some milk and cookies, ha, ha, ha. Well, he was like 33 years old and I'm 14. And he asked me how old I was. And I thought, I'm not going to lie. I said, I'm 14. He became more interested. So we wound up going back to his place and he said, oh, you can move in. And I think I did like right away or something like that. Well, it turns out he was a pedophile, obviously, a 33-year-old guy picking up a 14-year-old boy. And he would tell me stuff like, don't worry about your parents. I've written to the state and I'm now your legal guardian. I mean, all this crazy stuff that as a kid I wouldn't understand. But then we started, well, he would get these brown envelopes in the mail and open them up, and his drawer was filled with them. In those days, when you got porn, they were on 8mm film and they were all older guys with young boys. And I started thinking, I think I'm gay. So this must be what the culture is like when you're a young kid, gay, run away from home, an older man, out of the kindness of his heart, takes care of you because he understands that you're gay. And then you grow up and you're set free into the world. Didn't realize that it was an abusive pedophile, right? So then we started visiting other states. We went from New York, we'd go upstate, we'd go to Boston, we'd go to Connecticut. One time we went to Massachusetts, and the guy had to go to work emergency. Don't go near the windows. Don't let anybody see you. And I'm like, what? I don't understand. You know, we wound up in Washington, D.C. This, we must have been a senator or something. He had a huge townhouse in DuPont Circle, which is the gay area. And he had a Citroen Maserati and he had double California king bed. And we went around to pick up a couple of boys. And I was 14. They may have been 12, 13 years old. And five or six or eight of us were in bed while the guys were standing around watching. All right, guys, you know, time to play and have fun, you know, get naked. So at a certain point, it was like, you know, this is not what my friends do, but I tolerated it because I had nowhere else to go. Plus, he was fucking nuts. It was when they had Eric von Däniken and Chariot of the Gods and the Pyramids. And he used to tell me he talks to the space people and we have to leave a backpack. And one of these days they're going to get him. And when I said I'm going to run away, he said, we can find you with technology. And yeah, it was a really bad head trip. until one day we were out on Fire Island. We were dancing, and I was there was this woman, and I wound up dancing with her in the late '70s, great disco music, beginning of disco. And I said, "What do you do?" She said, "I'm an astrologer." I said, "Oh, you know about the space people coming and taking us away?" And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, you know, Bob over there who I live with." She goes, "You live with him? How old is he?" And I said, 33. And she goes, "Oh, well, what did he tell you?" "Well, the space people and this and that." She goes, "Can you sneak away tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." And she had a boat parked on a dock in the next community. She says, "Come over and tell me everything." I told her, and she said, "You have to get away from this man because this isn't right. And he sounds violent." And she arranged my parents to come pick me up and take me home, you know, and I ran away the next day anyway, but at least I was out of that situation. So I've been through it. Laid, relayed, parlayed, and souffled, as we say over here. I've been through it. And that's the only beginning of things.
Well, exactly. I mean, the next thing that I think possibly maybe you found a family when you went into the club scene. It was something more supportive,
well,
more different.
Before that, yes. Early clubs, we had Maxis Kansas City and CBGB. So we would see Aerosmith in their van, you know, play and then go downstairs, lean against the band and trying to get some pussy. You know, we'd see Debbie Harry was the bartender, jump up on stage. We got to see Talking Heads and I remember Devo and Brian Eno and David Bowie announced them on stage at Max's. And I saw Bruce Springsteen get booed off the stage for an acoustic set. So New York was a small town. As far as clubs, it wasn't like now where there's clubs everywhere. So you were either into rock and roll, jazz, or classical. So we hung out at the rock and roll clubs, and that later broke into the new wave clubs and then the dance clubs. So a lot of people, that crowd morphed from one to the next because that's what the trends were. So it became a little a clique of people that then suddenly with Studio 54 became famous people, you know what I mean? Hanging out with Andy Warhol. Keith Haring wasn't famous, the artist, but he hung out with us. Jean-Michel Basquiat was just this crazy black kid who was gay and straight and fucked anything that moved and was a painter, you know what I mean? So nobody was trying to be famous or fabulous. We were just weirdos, dysfunctional people, broken souls, and artists that kind of had solace with each other because I guess we saw suffering in each other and we didn't judge each other when the rest of the world did. Nobody could function. Nobody could hold a job down, you know, barely paid my rent, you know.
How did they deal with you as someone who's still, I presume you were still, you know, 15, 16 by the time you were going to clubs and lying to get in?
I lied. I was 18, 19. So I was old, you know, because I was tall. They thought I was 18 or 19 years old, and I just kept that lie going up for years. And clubs, you didn't have to show ID to get in. As long as you weren't a 12-year-old, you were probably old enough, you know. And I had purple hair and, you know, a white shirt and a tie and a skirt, you know what I mean? Before anybody had purple hair in New York, we used to get it from London. We'd get crazy color flown over, and I remember I'd go walk up Fifth Avenue, and the black girls would go, "That's your natural color." I said, "No, honey, green is not my natural color." Oh, I'd say yes. And, "Oh, y'all come over here and take a picture of my daughter, because they will not believe in New York City that people have red hair, you know, or green hair." So we were artists and freaks and living in lofts. We didn't even live in apartments because it was, I think it was for fear of being found out that you were broken. So we lived in plain sight underground. Let's put it that way, right? So some people were 30 years old and some people were my age and lying about it. So you runaways and off-duty drag queens with pancake and stubble, you know, it was broken people that found solace amongst each other.
Do you think by being in this sort of community of artists that in a sense, this had to be your destiny?
No, because, well, it was survival. And later on in my 20s and 30s, I was very sad because I feel like I missed my childhood, I missed my teenagerhood, and I missed my 20s when people had romance and discovered other people intimately. And I was, sleeping around or just so dysfunctional. Friends were hard to keep. Normal friends, you know, my crazy friends were crazy. But because they were crazy, they were hot and cold. One day they're your friend, the next day you're not. So it was very stressful. But I thought it's better that, you know, you lie to yourself. It's better than being like them out there. I'm not on the subway going to work every day. You know, I don't carry a briefcase, so I suffer, but I'm free. I'm free. Well, it was terrible. It's terrible for a 14-year-old kid to be amongst 30-year-olds that are, you know, you don't have the neurons in your brain to comprehend abuse, sexual abuse. Somebody likes you only because they want to get in your pants, and you're a lonely child, and you want to, oh, thank God you understand, you know, hug me. And then, you know, after you wipe the cum off, they're out of there, and you go, wait a minute, what? This must be me. This must be me. This must be me. I'm doing something wrong. So it was very stressful, you know, very stressful and very dysfunctional from my 14 to my 50s, wow. You know? Yeah, but that's also why people are creative. I mean, Jean-Michel Basquiat was, he would have sex with girls and sex with boys and go home and then make crazy paintings. You know what I mean? You know, Andy Warhol was socially dysfunction weirdo and would get it out by, you know, painting stuff. You know what I mean? So it would I change anything? I don't think so. But I tell you, when I was a young kid, I wanted to be a veterinarian. So would I be a veterinarian if I grew up normal and had a house and a picket fence and a wife, you know, living in the, or a husband, whatever it is? This made me grow balls. I was not afraid to do stuff. And when you do your first crazy thing, I'm not talking about harmful thing. I'm talking about purple hair or, you know, painting or doing some performance art. It's easy to do the next one. So you gain nerve, you gain confidence. I was afraid of people because I was abused, but within myself, I'm like, fuck it, I'll figure out a way to do it. I built my own synthesizer because I didn't have the money to buy one. Or, hey, can you come and play on my record? I'm not a musician, but I'll do it. You know what I mean? And somehow or another, I did it.
So what or who triggered your musical odyssey?
I think listening to records at home. I started buying, well, after Grand Funk Railroad, and that was horrible. I started buying funk records, Parliament. Funny enough, I bought a Village People record, not knowing their day or anything like that, and wound up managing them for 6 years later on, right? You know, but I bought Village People, and I bought Foxy Get Off, and I was interested in funky music. So it took me away from, you know, my horrible existence. And because I had built a synthesizer and had a tape recorder and a synthesizer, everybody in New York wanted to do a demo. Call Manny. You know, he's the guy, he's got a studio, and go in there and, you know, he'll do it for $25. You know, they probably said he's desperate. He'll do it for $25 instead of spending $100. But I was like, how can I help you? You know, please use me for hours and give me $25. You know, I had no boundaries. So because so many people came to me for work.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
I kind of got more and more and more interested in music. You know, being an actor and being a musician is not that far apart. You're using your brain for creativity. You visualize something and then you make it happen, either with your body through acting, as an artist through painting, or as music through music. You're either feeling something or you have an idea or concept you want to portray. So it's not that far apart from, you know, the path I was already on.
Had Warhol already given you your name, as it were, by then?
So, there was a photographer, Chris Makos, and we're fooling around on a regular basis. Sorry, Chris, well, everybody knows. Anyway, he worked for Interview Magazine, and he said, I'm going to get you in the What's Hot and Happening column of Interview, Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine. I said, great, and take some pictures. And he said, the pictures came back from the lab. You want to go up to the Andy Warhol factory to see how they came out. I said, sure. And it was in Union Square, 14th Street, 18th and 19th Street in Manhattan, Union Square. And we went up there and we're looking at the contact sheets and, you know, with the little magnifying lens, and Andy Warhol walks in, and I had seen him at some of the clubs. And I got, you know, hi, Mr. Warhol, you know, and he's like, what's going on? And I said, well, Manny Parrish, you know, is going to be in the thing. And we look at his pictures, he goes, Manny, that's too common. He said, we're going to change it to Man. And I said, Man? He goes, yeah. Man Ray was a photographer, so we're going to change it from Manny to Man. And I went, oh, okay, I don't care. Just put it in the paper. I don't call me Susan Blanche. You know, I don't care. And I just put it in the paper. I want my picture in the paper. And it came out, and it got a little traction. And somebody once introduced me to somebody a couple of weeks later as Man Parrish. And I went, ooh, that feels weird. No, I'm Manny. You know, no. And more and more people, Man Parrish, Ray Parrish. And I was like, okay, I can kind of get used to it. So, hey, man, what's up? And like, yeah, easy. So, yeah, that's how that happened. Andy Warhol gave me my name. And when we would go to places like Studio 54, Andy was there and all these people, and nobody bothered anybody. People had weird names. So it was just one of the other ones, you know, Sting, you know, Slash, you know, whatever, you know, you were one of them, you know.
Now, you talked about that you had your own synthesizer at home. Had you actually then moved back into your parents by then?
No, that was home and where I was living in a loft. My first one I built myself at that pedophile's place because he was a tinkering, soldering geek. Later on, I had them. In fact, I was living in a loft on 38th Street in Manhattan with Joey Arias, who some people may know that listen to you. He's a performer who worked with Klaus Nomi and worked in my show later on. I needed a ARP 2600 synthesizer, which at that time was about $2,000 or $2,500. And I was friendly with my parents only when I needed something. And I called them up and I said, Mom, I need $2,500 for a synthesizer. She said, I'm not giving you that kind of money. And I said, Mom, if you don't give me that kind of money, I'm going to become a male prostitute and sell drugs and raise the money that way. She said, let me call you back. I'm going to speak to your father. 20 minutes later, I got a phone call back. All right, meet us in the city at the music store. We'll get it for you. You know what I mean? So, so the stuff that I had, as I moved along, I would buy synthesizers and more gear. And the more synthesizers and gear I bought, the more people came to record. So I made $50, $100, and I was able to eat. So that's how I built my collection.
As an artist of faith, my creativity and spirituality are integral to my identity.
But I'm caught between two worlds.
Luckily, I found Be Make Do, and I'm ready to be who I was created to be.
Be Make Do, the podcast. Listen at soulmakers.org/bemakedo.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
So later on, how did you actually start hip hop bebop? How did you start there?
You know, a lot happened between then and that time. Studio 54 and all that kind of came down from the ceiling. Madonna was my opening act. We used to get in every weekend with my friend. She knew the doorman, and I said to her, "Were you fucking the doorman?" This is just recently. She goes, "Oh no! My father was in the mafia, and I was selling Quaaludes. I was the house dealer." And we were like 15 years old, driving into Brooklyn. So we got into every party. So they knew me. So we went to play at Studio 54, a Fear Richie party, an unknown singer, Madonna was my opening act. I went, came down from the ceiling. They loved the show so much.
Wait a minute, you came down from the ceiling. What is that?
So the day that we did rehearsal at Studio 54, I had just come from the cemetery burying my mother. I had lost my loft, and I was with David Bowie's manager, and he dropped me because I delivered rock and roll music, which I shouldn't have delivered, to Elektra Records when they signed me for Hip Hop Bebop, because David Bowie's manager was rock and roll. Don't do synthesizers. Dance music is never going to be anything. Synthesizers are a fad. You need to get a guitar. So I produced a demo, and they were like, what? Anyway, I played Studio 54. It was Fear Ruchi's 10th anniversary party. And I showed up for rehearsal. They wouldn't let me in, by the way. I had to bang on the door and go away. You know, I said, some security guard came out and was going to beat me up because I was bothering them. Anyway, they said, how do you want to make an entrance? And I don't know, my brain snapped. And my mother just died. And, you know, I had no place to live. And I said, I want to come down from the ceiling. And they went, okay, we can arrange that. There's a funny story, which I could tell and not tell, where I was stuck up there on a little parakeet perch for about a half hour, and I had a panic attack, and there was neon on either side of me, and they said, don't swing back and forth because there's 20,000 volts of neon, you'll die electrocuted. So they said, we're gonna lower you on the next song, and the DJ was a diva, and he wasn't ready to release it. So I'm up there in a corduroy outfit above the 1,000-watt light, you know, must have been 130 degrees, temperature hot, swinging back and forth. It was crazy. Anyway, I got lowered down, and that night Henry Kissinger was dancing with a tranny, and the Secret Service came and pushed her out of the way, pushed Brooke Shields in there. And if you Google, there's a picture of Henry Kissinger at Studio 54 dancing with Brooke Shields, but he was actually coming on to a tranny and didn't realize it. And the second time I played, George Lucas asked if I could do the opening part, the New York premiere party for Return of the Jedi. They had an after party at studio, and I came a second time. But you had asked me how Hip Hop Bebop comes. So with the synthesizers, I couldn't read or write music. So I was doing, it's now called ambient music. I called them soundscapes. I would do sounds and blend them together and, you know, mix different sounds and make these tapes of blended music. The 808 drum machine came out. And before that, drum machines were only those little bossa nova boxes that people would rehearse to. But the 808 drum machine from Roland allowed you to program beats. And I'm not a musician, but for the first time in my life, I realized I could be a one-man band like Kraftwerk, because I could program the beats, write the bass line, and I got Electric Light Orchestra's vocoder for $25 from a music store because they didn't want it anymore. So now I could sing and play keyboards and do all that kind of stuff. So I had done a soundtrack for a porn movie, and my friend was doing a really sleazy magazine, and they were talking to the director, and he said, he's looking for a guy for music. Why don't I suggest you? And I said, sure. So I thought, well, I'm a teenage boy. I'm going to sit around all day with my dick in my hand, one hand in my dick and the other on the keyboard. I'm going to watch porn and make music. This is great, you know. So we wound up, he called me. He said, I need an hour, 20 minutes of music here, 5 minutes of music there, 7 for this scene, 9. I said, well, what about the movie? He says, oh, you don't get to see it. Just give me the music. I'll cut it in. Movie comes out maybe 2 months later, somebody says they're playing your song at a club called The Anvil in New York. And I was like, what song? They said, Heatstroke. And I went, can't be. Record isn't out. Go down there. I walk in. There's a fire-breathing drag queen on stage. She gets off. A guy comes on stage and sits on giant dildos and squirts them across the other side of the room, and everybody's applauding. It's just like, and I thought, oh my God, I love this place. I feel like I'm home. You know, because I came from Andy Warhol, where everything is like performance art. And this is like, this is too crazy to be real. It's like, you know, dinner and a show, you know what I mean? It's like, it's amazing. So I called up to the DJ booth, my song came on, and I said, that's my song. No request. I said, no, that's my song. What do you mean it's your song? And I said, I did that song. So he goes, I got that off. I said, where'd you get it? He goes, off of a Betamax tape. I made a test pressing, an acid tape. And he was playing it with all the moaning and groaning from the porn movie, but he liked the music. He says, there's a record label. and they'd love to put it out. It's called DiscoNet, a DJ subscription service. And I'll take you up there tomorrow. And I signed a one paragraph, grandmother's furniture, firstborn contract with no royalty. You know what I mean? It's mine, not yours. Get out. And come on, you don't need to go to a lawyer. Would I screw you? You know, kind of thing. I'm still fighting over it, you know, 45 years.
Did you read it? Did you ever read that?
I was 22-year-old dysfunctional kid with a ninth grade education. And therefore, with the sum of the 60-day royalty at 6 points minus the damages, I'm like, what? So I read it and I'm like, I couldn't afford a lawyer anyway. And I thought, you know what? I'll just get this record out. Record comes out, it does pretty well. And then this guy says, I'm going to send the, he was a executive in an advertising agency, didn't really have a label yet. I'm going to send the office boy. He knows about music. He's a DJ down to you. And why don't you play him some of your homemade tapes? So Hip Hop Bebop was one of many songs that he listened to. And he said to me, we're going to take you out to the Fun House, which is an urban electro dance club in New York. We went out that night. We went into the DJ booth, which was like the size of a living room with couches and drinks and all that. And John Jellybean Benitez was DJing. And next to him was a girl with black hair and hairy armpits with a T-shirt that said, I'm Madonna. And we used to call her the skank, right? You know, oh, he's with the skank. Arthur Baker is there, a couple of other people. I didn't know. They put on a song and everybody goes, ooh, 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 ooh. And I thought, what the fuck? What's going on? Do we have to run to the exits? Oh, no, 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 no. He said, that's what it's like when everybody likes the song here. They bark at it. I said, listen, why don't we take that, it wasn't called Hip Hop Bebop, that piece of music with the beats and no structure. Why don't we bark at these guys and we'll make a test pressing. They'll bark back and we'll all have a laugh, end of day. So that's what we do. I had it on my 8-track machine. We put it up on the 24-track. There was no song structure. So one track I'm going, hey, ho, for 5 minutes. The next one, you know, hip hop, hip hop, hip hop, hip hop, hip hop, you know, whatever. We I think they did 3 10-inch reels, which is what, 45 minutes and 60 minutes. So there was like 3 hours of combinations of outtakes. And they sat over the weekend doing MDA and Coke with a razor blade and edited together Hip Hop Bebop. Comes out, it does really exceptionally well. And I was wondering why it did so well, because the owner of the record company was putting little bags of cocaine inside of each Man Parish album and mailing it to Billboard DJs and to radio stations with a thing like, I hook you up, now hook us up and report this and put it in. So that only went so far. And then I had an idea. There was a big radio station in New York, went out to like millions. You know, New York's like 5-7 million people, went out to millions of people. I said, why don't I do the station call letters in vocoder, 92, K2. Nobody else had done that. I was the first person to do it. And in exchange, they would put any song that I played into heavy rotation, a form of payola, without, as long as it didn't have dirty words in it. So Hip Hop Bebop blew up on that station, and then they called the other station, and you guys are out of touch, and then 2 stations, and then, you know, it leapfrogs from there, you know what I mean, and becomes a record. I hated that record. I hated that record, because I wanted to be like Depeche Mode. I wanted to be like Vince Clark. I wanted to have a song with a verse and a chorus, and, you know, I was listening to British electro pop at the time. And I was embarrassed that this was just dogs barking, hey ho, no song structure. But if you listen to it, it's about the sound, which is my basis of the ambient music that I was doing. You could follow kind of the thread through there, you know what I mean? But when that came out, I was furious. Like, no, no, no.
But do you perceive it differently today?
It took me a very long time because I thought people were crazy. And after the record company screwed me, I walked away from them. I spent about 10 or 15 years. Well, I had a party in New York called Sperm at a bar called The Cock, which was, I mean, it sounds worse than it was, but it was actually worse than it sounds. You know what I mean? It wasn't supposed to be as wild of a party as, but if you go to a party called Sperm, you're putting your feet up on the furniture, or you're walking around naked with your sneakers on, which people did for, you know, I'd be at the DJ booth and somebody would walk past me and I'm like, holy fuck, they're naked. You know what I mean? It's like, so I had very wild party, but up until then, I didn't realize the impact that record had, right? And I just thought, well, you know, it's a dance record. But then I started getting interviews, and DJs were going, you can understand that was a breakthrough record. And, you know, people, it's the reason I got into music, and nothing sounded like that at the time, and so on and so on and so on. And it's after a bunch of people telling me, I thought, well, maybe there's something there. You know what I mean? So now I look at it differently. I still don't 100% understand it because I'm on the inside looking out, but it was one of those things, you know, was I in the right place at the right time? Was I a musical genius to, you know, did the gods above filter through me and made the music? I don't know. I don't know. But I never got paid. And I, to this
day, Was it down to the manager? It was Bowie's manager, and he completely
ripped you off. He said, you leave that behind. That's not important. I'm going to get you on Elektra Records, and you're going to have a real career. You know what I mean? So I couldn't fight that stuff. I didn't have the money. You know, a lawyer would have been $5,000 of, retainers. And I barely
What were they spending the money on?
So the record company, I walked away because I wasn't getting paid. And he went from a broom closet in his advertising agency to quitting it. And him and Raul, the mailboy, they went to a office and had like 15 people working for them. So he wanted me back because the goose that laid the golden eggs is no longer around. He says, let me come pick you up. I'm like, I don't want to talk and roll. I said, come on, talk to him, Captain Mike. Captain Mike, yeah, he's got a plane. I got it. Okay, all right. So he says, I'll come pick you up. We'll go have lunch. Picks me up in a top-of-the-line Porsche with a hand-carved dashboard. We get in it. We drive out to a private airport and get into this private plane. And I'm like, what the fuck? So we fly from New York all the way up to Boston, Martha's Vineyard. We have lunch and come on, Manny. You know we love you. You know, I said, you haven't paid me. Oh, it'll be different this time. And we get back in the plane and we take off. And I said, wow, this plane is like really expensive. He goes, oh, yeah, do another record. You'll buy me another one. And at that point, I went, holy fucking shit. That's my Porsche. This is my airplane. That office with 20 people working, I did that. And I looked out the window and I wouldn't speak to him. I got in the car, I looked out the window and wouldn't turn my head even straight. And it was weird silence. And he dropped me off. I slammed the door and never talked to him again. You know, and ironically, years later, he died of AIDS. And I went to go help him because he was lost in Houston, because I'm a nice guy, right? But I walked away from music. So I didn't know the impact that Boogie Down Bronx Hip Hop Bebop. I mean, Boogie Down Bronx was another big one. That was done in I lost my loft. I moved back to Brooklyn to my father's house. My mother died. I was living in the apartment above, which we owned, a two-story house. And the bedroom was my recording studio. And the kid was a kid from the neighborhood. And I said, we're doing this track. We need a rhyme on it. And he came up and did that all in one take, Boogie Down Bronx, you know. And, you know, people say, well, because of you, the term Boogie Down Bronx. I'm like, eh. Well, because I spoke to people like Todd Terry and those people, and us Detroit guys, we used to play techno tracks. You invented techno. I mean, I didn't do any. If you want to say it, I'll take the credit. But I was just a struggling kid, and I don't call myself a musician because I can't read or write music. If you look at my social media, it says "Man Parish Artist." I'm not pulling a Prince trip, but I can't sit in a room with musicians. I don't know what key my shit is in. I have a program that I have to drop the music in, and it tells me it's an E flat. And then I got to go look on a chart to see what notes are black and what's a white. To this day, 50 years, I've been in the music business 50 years. So I'm doing an art installation in New York, and it involves a glory hole with audio behind it. You sit on a chair and you listen in the glory hole, and I'm going to tell dirty stories. So my stuff has always been like performance art stuff. My sperm party every weekend had, we'd take a storefront and we'd move the furniture around and put up a portable walls and light it with lasers. And we'd have live painters and naked dancers and performance artists and stuff like that. So I'm more on the art side of thing, but I have 147 records out there I just saw the other day. So, you know.
I just want to mention the 80s, because when I was in London in the 80s and used to go to gay clubs then, and then in 92, I went back to this gay club and interviewed the owner, who was a straight Greek guy.
Which club?
Oh, it was Lasers. It was in North London. And it was, they had an evening called Bolts, I think it was called. And it was just like,
Bolts is the record label. Bolts was the record label to put out Man to Man.
Yeah. Well, that's every week they would have really great artists like Divine would be on stage.
To do his record. And I was meeting with his manager that night. He went out to California. He was going to be Peg's mother with Unmarried with Children, the TV show. And he choked on a sandwich or his vomit and died. And I was supposed to do his next record. And I thought, my God, millions of people. I'm finally going to make money. And sure enough, that happened, you know. I was also supposed to do Sylvester, but he hated synthesizers. So I messed up on that one, too.
But the thing about the 80s was, I remember like 10 years later, when I go back, I asked the guy, you know, this club was so successful. Why did you close it? And he said everyone died. And New York, you were the epicenter in a sense.
So that happened when AIDS happened in New York. It wasn't even cold AIDS. It was cold grid, gay-related immune deficiency. And friends of ours started to get sick. Frank's in the hospital. What do you mean? He's got all these black bruises all over his body, and they're saying it's a cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma, and they don't know what it is, but they're starting to notice this in gay guys. And it's like, did you kiss somebody and get that? Did you get fucked in the ass and get it? Did you hold hands and get it? Did you eat or drink from a cup? Did you get it from a toilet seat or a doorknob? So when people ask me about COVID, I tell them it's AIDS 2.0 for me, you know what I mean? But the only difference is now there's a government there that's trying to stop it. Well, we were a bunch of puffs and a bunch of fags and queers, and who cares? Let them die. You know, I remember visiting Klaus Nomi and other friends in the hospital. You would go up and get off the elevator, and all the rooms, the doors to all the rooms, they would isolate a floor, and all the rooms were closed, and the nurses were in practically space outfits because they didn't know what it was. And you had to put on paper, a full jumpsuit, rubber gloves, and they taped your hands. They gaffer taped, you know, your wrist. And we had to have masks on and face shields and stuff covering our hair because they didn't know what it was. And all the doors had the biohazard doors signs on it. And I remember going in the room and Klaus was sitting there setting up, and he had spots all over him. And he was freaked out. And I said, let me give you a hug. He goes, no. I said, no, I'm going to give you a hug. Nobody's, don't touch them and don't go near them. And they're lepers, you know what I mean? And I gave him a hug and he held on just a little extra long, like, oh, you know, somebody's talking. Nobody else in the room did. Everybody else was like, you're crazy. I'm like, no, I don't care. If I die, I die. But that's the kind of person I am. I have a heart because I've been through a lot of pain.
Did you feel guilt at surviving?
And you know what's even weirder is, I mean, everybody that I slept with, I was no angel. You know, I was a man. You know, there were bathhouses, glory holes, sex clubs, cruising areas, bushes. I even went to Brompton Cemetery once when I was in England with Man to Man. I remember my cruising days. But I'm like, you have sex in the cemetery? Why? Is that weird? Like, that's where we go. And make sure you get out by 5 o'clock. Otherwise, you have to climb the fence to get out because I'll lock you in. I'm like, this is insane. But I'm not HIV positive, and I don't know why. Everybody that I dated or was with, they wanted to do some sort of tests on me. They believe some people may be immune to it. So I'm not going out for risky behavior to put it to the test, but for some reason, I never got it. Did I feel guilty? No, I feel blessed and lucky that I never got it, but I turned that guilt and that weirdness into this incredible compassion of, what can I do to help? Are you okay? It was the gay community, because Reaganomics and whatever it was, the political stuff, wouldn't support people that were dying. So what they did is, Jeffrey Katzenberg, I think, got God's Love We Deliver. A lot of these people were in walk-up tenement apartments that 2 weeks to get down to eat. So they bought old ice cream trucks that had refrigeration, and they would cook food in their home and put it into takeout trays. And these guys would drive it around and feed people. You know, I held a couple of people as they died, you know, because there was nobody. Their families wouldn't take them home to die at home. Would family take care of, because either, well, you're gay, you're going to burn in hell. Or one person said, we can't take you home because what would the neighbors think? Right? So we became a bunch of tough old birds. I jokingly tell people, you know, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I got a brick in my purse, you know, if I need it, you know what I mean? I'll just hit you with my pocketbook. It's got a brick. I was raised by drag queens in the Village People. I can cut the mustard if I have to, you know what I mean? It's like, you toughen up, but you know, you also become incredibly sensitive. I mean, I fucking cry at TV commercials. Forget about the movies. I have to go in the second or third row at noon when there's nobody there and crowds down like, oh my God. And I get out of the movie. I just saw the saddest movie. What did you see? Star Wars. Are you kidding me? You know what I mean? So it makes you very sensitive, which also is good for the music because it leaves a lot of depth to it. So
one person,
the stuff was really hard, really, really hard. Really,
one person really that you met in your life who it's such a fascinating story was Michael Ehrlich.
Michael Ehrlich. So yeah, okay. So
where did you meet him, first of all?
Well, originally he was a club kid. So if you've seen Party Monster, any of those movies, and if anybody out there doesn't know who Michael Ehrlich is, he's a club kid, kind of like in Europe, what's his name? Oh my God, Kenny, any of those club kids, they were paid to be, you know, fabulous in a club. They would come in outfits, you know, like the Boy George crowd. Yeah, Steve Strange, who I got to work with before he died, thank God. But they were paid to dress up and create havoc in clubs because people would come and watch the show. So I knew him from clubs, he knew me. New York was still a small town, so I was doing records. I had my Eric, he knew me. So that whole thing goes down where he kills his drug dealer, goes to jail, comes back out. And about 4 days later, I get a phone call. And I didn't recognize the number. And he goes, man, Parrish. And I went, yeah. He goes, this is Michael Ehrlich. And I was like, Michael Ehrlich? He goes, I said to him, like, are you sure? He goes, oh, no, I'm out of jail. I want to talk to you. And I thought, If I do a record with this guy, everybody that I know will disown me because it was a really horrible situation. But the other side of me is, I gotta fucking talk to him and ask him what happened from the source. This is amazing. So I picked him up in Manhattan. He was in jail so long, he didn't know what a cell phone was. He didn't know what a computer was. He didn't know what the internet was. He was learning and telling me all this stuff in the car. Like, they gave me a cell phone. I'm really not sure how to use it. And people have computers now. And I'm like, oh, yeah. They have and you could dial on the internet. I said, yeah, Michael, yeah. That, you know, cable TV. And, you know, he was in jail for many, many years. He had cut up his drug deal. So he goes, I guess you're going to want to know the story. And I'll see if I can do a condensed version. I'm like, fuck yeah. And for 2 hours, we drove around New York. And I remember it was raining. My windshield wipers were on. I wasn't even looking out the window. He said, well, you know, we were all high and my drug dealer wouldn't shut up. So I think we hit him over the head. We threw something at him or hit him over the head to jokingly, like, you know, shut up and banged him on the head, wound up killing him. And we kept saying, wake up, wake up. So they went to the police station, all high with makeup on and half in drag and whatever. And they said, we killed somebody. This is from Michael Ehrlich telling me this. And the cop said, sure you did. And I'm, you know, and I'm Princess Diana, get out of here. And then they went back to the apartment and the angel, his name, is laying there with blood. And like, what are we going to do? Let's call the police again. And they said, if you call us one more time, we're going to arrest you. So they did more drugs and they said, we got to do something, put him in the bathtub and let's figure out to do it. They came back the next day, the body was starting to decay. And they said they did more drugs and they've been up for 2 or 3 days hallucinating that we have to cut him up and put him in a garbage bag. And they do that, right? Which is unbelievable. They put it in a garbage bag and hail a taxi. And of course the bag's dripping blood. And they tell the taxi to take him down to the river. And they throw the bag in the river. Of course, the bag opens up and like a hand comes floating up to the surface and they say, take me back home. Of course, the cab driver calls the cops and that's how they got arrested. So, I mean, my life is full of stories like this. So it's fucking amazing. You know, Steve, I often wonder why me, but now I'm telling these stories I have Man Parrish stories on youtube.com and I'm telling these stories because they're so fucking crazy that, you know, it's like I can't believe it myself, but all this crazy shit happened. Old famous people, Michael Alex, you know, I'm in Halston's apartment, you know, on that couch that's on the Netflix special, and sitting next to me is Liza Minnelli and then Diana Vreeland from Vogue, and then Bianca Jagger and Mick Jagger and my friend Linda, and then Andy Warhol, and then Liza, you know, and on and on and on.
And there's all these throwaway lines that you do, like Madonna. Yeah, I know,
but it was like, it's like throwaway lines, but that was just like normal, and they're doing like giant serving platters full of Coke until like 10 o'clock in the morning, grinding their jaws, you know what I mean? It's like, how did a kid from Brooklyn, who wasn't even that famous then or anything, wind up in these situations? Well, my friend Linda was their drug dealer, you know what I mean, at 1450. But, you know, I toured the world with the Village People, you know, and now I'm going from a fan to somebody who's producing their shows live on stage around the world. You know, I flew the Concorde. I worked with Boy George, Michael Jackson, Gloria Gaynor, Roberta Flack, Steve Strange, Steve Bronski, Man to Man, you know. So, and in fact, if you're from England, around that time, 96, when Bolts was happening, I arrived in London, and this crazy queen who worked for Bolts Records, I had called Paul Zone. He put that record out without asking me. My name was not supposed to be on that record because I just had a record out, and he used my name to get climb the charts. So, all right, come to London, we'll work it out. So I get off the plane, and this crazy queen says, well, we have to go for an interview. I said, what interview? He goes, see all those people over there, and I'm in the airport. All those people, that's the British press, and they want to speak to you. And I said, why do they want to speak to me? He goes, oh, don't worry, darling. I told them you're fucking Madonna. I said, what? No. I look like shit. I have sweatpants on, a t-shirt, my hair. He goes, I just told them that you arrived on the Concorde because you were up all night, you know, mixing your next record. And I said, give me your sunglasses. I'm not going to say anything. He goes, don't worry, darling. I'll cover it. First word out of her mouth is, so what's it like having sex with Madonna? And I went, oh, fuck. He goes, Manny's got scratch marks over his back because he does her so well. And I thought, this is fucking crazy. I said, oh my, I start shaking. And then the next question is, what about Sean Penn? He goes, while they're having sex, they tell Sean Penn jokes and they call him Poison Penn. And I thought, this is getting crazier and crazier. And they said, well, how does Madonna, and she wasn't super, super famous. She was really famous, but not the level she's on now. And then it was like, how does Madonna get to Manny's house in Brooklyn? Well, Manny has a maid named Beulah who has an old Ford, wraps her in a blanket and a sheet, pulls right up to the side door of Manny's house and quickly opens the door, and Madonna runs in and they have sex for hours and hours and hours. And I thought, this is so crazy. They're not going to print this. So we were staying, I was staying in like some horrible, in Earl's Court, some horrible like rooming house where you put 5p into the thing just to get the heat, you know what I mean? And he knocks on the door and puts down the newspaper, and I'm on the front cover of the bottom half of News of the World, Madonna longs for my baby, Man Parish Kiss and Tell Lover. And then I'm on the Standard and one of the other papers too about how I'm fucking Madonna. And he said, are you hungry? Do you want to go for breakfast? I said, I'm starving. He goes, oh, I've arranged a whole week of interviews for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so we don't have to pay for it, for you doing this thing. So after three or four, he was answering all the questions. I said, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. I didn't know. Can I get arrested? You know what I mean? They're like, am I in trouble? So he goes, perfect idea. We're going to have you in a hotel room with a girl in bed, and we're going to find a hotel with connecting balconies, and we're going to have the photographer go to the next room and climb out on the balcony and catch you in bed with cheating on Madonna, and they'll put it in the papers, and that'll be the end of it. So I'm lying in bed with this girl, and we're laughing, and she's got a tube top on. I have my shirt off. She goes, there's someone on the balcony. Someone on the balcony. I turn around and go, hey, you! And I'm pointing, and my mouth goes, ooh! And they snap a picture. It winds up in the photo in the thing the next day, and it wasn't the end of it. I mean, Madonna's brother came after me and wanted to get really nothing from Madonna, you know, and then somebody printed a clown sitting on a log. It's that fat oaf Man Parish lying, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, that was a fun little period, you know.
I want to end on on something, because when you talked about at the beginning, you said that you've had therapy. And yeah. I just wonder how, I mean, I've had six therapists in my life and I'm still in
this
therapy.
This is trauma therapy.
I do that. And it's fantastic.
Yeah, sexual trauma therapy, yeah. Abuse trauma therapy.
And how has that worked for you? And how much do you think you are now in a state where you said maybe you could have a good relationship? Maybe things could...
Well, I'm in a relationship for 22 years or something like that. And we got married as you know, I got old enough for the pension, the Social Security. It's like, let's get married. We make more money this way. But we've been together 22 years, 23 years. We're like a bunch of old lesbians. We have, you know, dogs instead for children. You know what I mean? And this is my studio. I don't think this is a video thing, but there's a studio behind me. I do more work now than ever. I had a lot of, let's put it this way. I had more issues than Reader's Digest. Okay. I mean, I would always have a dream of a man in a dark hallway, you know, trying to hurt me. I was afraid that people were going to break into the house and harm me. I had weird neuroses. At one point, I had strange claustrophobia in elevators. I had panic attacks for 20 years, and I refused to take drugs because I didn't want anything controlling me because I had been controlled for so long. So I suffered for a very long time. I was also a very difficult person to be friends with because I was very needy and very broken. So I didn't have boundaries, or I didn't know other people's boundaries. So it was hard to be around me. I thought you had friends for 3 months and it was normal and you went on to your next group of friends, you know? So therapy has helped me understand the core, why I have anxieties and fears and problems. And as though it's like an onion, and I'm Manny. I'm not an addict, but I'm an alcoholic. Like you do in a 12-step program. Once you realize you've got a problem, there's two ways to fix it. You could take chemicals like Prozacs and Paxils, or you could do cognitive behavior therapy, which literally, it's almost like the Stockholm syndrome. You reprogram your brain through repetition to change the way the literal neurons program your brain. And I choose the latter, and it takes a little bit of time, but I'm in a much healthier place. I don't feel guilty or bad or I feel lost because I lost my childhood and sad that I had to go through it. And I didn't have I smiled on the outside. I cracked a lot of jokes, but on the inside was a very broken boy that never grew up, you know, didn't have a mother. I'd never got hugged, never got kissed, didn't have, you know, bonding friendships like you do through your teen years or beautiful relationships in your 20s and your 30s. Mine were dysfunctional and in the days, weeks later. So the therapy now has explained to me why there was so much dysfunction, and I'm piecing it together. And when I get panic attacks and when I get dysfunctional, I have what they call tools. So I recognize patterns now. You know, Manny, you're a little manic, or you haven't slept, or, too much caffeine, and you're speeding all over the place. Time to calm down. And the person that I'm with is a rock solid idiot. No, he's just like a stone. It's like, you know what? Chill out. I'm like, yeah. All right. I'm bouncing. Come on back, Manny. You're bouncing on the walls. So with all that, I'm better than I've ever been before. There's sadness that'll never go away. There's pain and fears that'll never go away, but it's like diabetes. You manage it. You always have the disease, but you learn how to manage your problems. You know what I mean? A diabetic doesn't eat a cake because they know their sugar's going to go through the roof or they're going to go into a coma. Well, I don't stay up past. It's not a time thing. If I've slept 4 hours over 3 days, I make sure I take the next day off. Or if I'm feeling like I can't deal with anything, I chill the fuck out. Let the world blow up. I don't give a fuck. Before, it was like, no, I have to fix this, or somebody needs my help. And, so boundaries. I've learned boundaries, and I've learned to, I'm a better person. I'm more focused. Yeah, we have a place in New York, and I'm down here in Florida. I do more work than ever.
more work than ever. I'm putting out albums every two months or 3 months, and I'm doing remixes and, you know, art installations and stuff. So the therapy has helped.
Brilliant. Well, look, Manny, I just want to say thank you, because you've had an enormous contribution to popular culture.
Still makes me feel weird. I don't understand that. I say to my therapist, I say to other people, if I was more of a cunt, I'd probably be more famous. Because when I walk in a room, I kind of stand off in the corner. I don't pull my dick out and say, I'm Man Parrish, suck me. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people do. I don't, oh, you're a Man Parrish, you contributed to culture. And I'm like, oh, me, oh, I'm too shy. You know, I because I associate that with bad attitude and bad ego and bad personality. So you gave me a wonderful compliment. But my first reaction is, oh, no. I'm just, I'm Manny. So thank you for the compliment. Because if I don't, my therapist will kill me for not saying that. But I do mean it. Thank you for the compliment. You know what I mean? And I've never got paid, but it's interviews like this. And I say this over and over again, which mean the world to me, because you're interested in my story. Hopefully Netflix will be interested in my story.
Man, that's what I was going to say. I look forward to not just the 10 part one series, series on Netflix.
Spider-Man is a kid who lives in Queens and goes to school during the day, and at night he saves the world. I want to do Manny is a kid that lives in Brooklyn, goes out at night and hangs out with Andy Warhol, and then gets back on the train and comes back to Brooklyn and has, you know, breakfast with his, you know, with his mom. So I want to do that kind of a series. But yeah, thank you for thinking that I'm relevant. Thank you.
Looking for a fun way to win up to 25 times your money this basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. You could turn $10 into $250. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/fan and use code FAN. That's code FAN at prizepicks.com/fan.
Must be present in certain states. Visit PrizePicks.com for restrictions and details.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
it's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.